Well, holiday greetings, everyone. It is another holiday weekend here in Turdville, as it's the American holiday of Thanksgiving. And we are all very thankful in Turdville for a number of things, but of course we are always very thankful for the contributions of the Jackass. And so we have a holiday tradition here in at TFMR that whenever we have a an extended weekend, we'd like to bring in the Jackass for a full update from him on the current state of affairs. Jim, if you don't know him, is the writer, the publisher of the Hat Trick Letter. And you can find him at goldenjackass.com. We'll get more into that later as to how a subscription works and why you should have one. But before we get started, I'd just like to welcome Jim back. Jim, it's always great to hear from you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, it's good to be back. It's been a while. I guess Labor Day, we're trying to figure out when was the previous holiday. I thought it was July 4th, but there was Labor Day in there. Well, I tell you, you know, if you just step aside for a month or two, this is what I said early in 2014. This is going to be the year of accelerated breakdown.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're seeing it in spades. Well, I'm noticing now that we have four places where things are totally breaking apart. I know your favorite one to start with.
Well, you know what? That's probably the biggest change. Well, and one of the biggest changes since we last spoke over the Labor Day holiday in early September. You know, this the Japanese have been rushing to devalue the yen now for years, but it's been awful bad for the last couple of years. And of course, they announced two, 3 weeks ago that they were going to expand their already exaggerated quantitative easing program to the point where they are now buying every single new bond issue in Japan, completely monetizing their debt. And with the money left over, they're buying ETFs and all sorts of things. A lot of folks out there think they're playing with fire and that it is going to cause an escalating problem. I'm sure you probably have some thoughts on that, Jim, don't you?
I could speak for 2 hours on this.
I would imagine.
Well, here's some of my quick thoughts. For 20 years, Japan has been caught with 0% in the corner. How come they never got out of it? How come the United States believes that we can go to 0% and never come out of it when Japan never did?
Right.
Japan also went into the QE corner of monetizing their debt. How come they never got out of it? What makes us think that once we get into it, we can get out of it? We can't. We're stuck at 0% and QE forever, infinity. I call it ZIRP, 0% forever and QE to infinity. The Japanese actually stated that they're going to have unlimited QE. They've gone out when pressed for details. They said, well, we think this year our monetization might be on the order of $2 trillion. Now, bear in mind that their population is about one-third the United States. So if the United States did something on a per capita basis that was equivalent, we would have to print $6 trillion a year. Jeez. You think that's going to cause a problem?
Maybe.
Okay, it's much, much deeper than that. I look at coincident events, and I have a rule. There's no such thing as a billion-dollar coincidence. And when it comes to $1 trillion, they're all orchestrated. So simultaneously, I think it was the same week, maybe a day or two apart, the United States, well, the Fed, it's more like an international cabal of criminal bankers. The U.S., I call it U.S. Fed because it's on our soil. I still think of us as United States. I'm still holding a U.S. passport and still regard myself as a patriot trying to recover our nation. But only a day or two apart, simultaneously, effectively, the Fed announced that they were going to end QE, that it's over. It's been a success. And my joke was, it's kind of like Vietnam. Declare victory and move.
Yeah, move on.
Move out. Move out. Even if it means from the rooftops, escaping with your lives. Declare victory and move out. Haul ass. Okay, so the Fed hauled ass. And I immediately said, liar, liar, pants on fire. And I wondered, well, where is the Fed going to do their subterranean QE? Because no one's buying their trillion-dollar debt. The U.S. – oh, gosh, it's so funny. I'm quickly diverting here, but it'd be quick. It was September that the U.S. Treasury Department announced that the debt for the year was really only $580 billion. It went down, but it was laden with adjustments. Right. How do you adjust on an annual report? I mean, that makes no sense at all. Usually they're seasonal adjustment. Anyway, they had these little adjustments, I guess, for putting in bullshit factors. But if you just took the end of fiscal 2014, subtracted end of fiscal 2013, which a fourth grader can do, which is way over the heads of the Treasury Department economists, you get $1.1 trillion deficit for the year. Okay, so they're going to have to finance the $1.1 trillion deficit because that's real. Their accounting bullshit is just that. Nonsense.
Yep.
Simultaneous to the Fed announcing an end to their successful, wonderful QE that wrecked the global economy, the Japanese announced unlimited QE. And I said, all right, bingo, there it is. So, subterranean, the Japanese were going to buy treasury bonds. And then it wasn't so much a light bulb as articles coming out and analysts pointing out that the United States has made a formal request to the Japanese that their $1.2 trillion pension funds, not their national pension fund across the country for private corporations, but their government pension fund. You know, postal workers, government workers, they got a big bureaucracy there. $1.2 trillion would be devoted directly for treasury bonds. And I immediately asked the question, because I don't just take a statement and say, oh, that's wonderful, let me put that over here. No, I say, well, what does that mean for their interest rates if they're going to dump $1.2 trillion in Japanese government bonds? So I immediately thought, okay, unlimited QE to replace the bonds that are going to be confiscated by the U.S., ordered from their vassals living in Tokyo, that are on orders ever since World War II ended.
Right.
That are under threat from the Yakuza of execution if their bankers don't follow orders, paid by Langley. Now, that bears repeating. Their banking policy is done in Washington, executed in Tokyo. If they don't follow their instructions, the Japanese mafia will murder them, paid on contract by Langley. Okay?
So all of the ideas, this Abe and his whole plan, emanates really from Washington.
Right. Abe is pretty much a U.S. tool, and I think he's going to get booted out real soon, and it's going to be interesting. So the Japanese announced unlimited, and I thought, okay, they're going to print extra money, a lot of extra money, recover quickly their shell game used for the $1.2 trillion pension fund for the government workers and postal workers. And the evidence for the smoking gun will be a fast-falling yen. Mm-hmm. And there it is.
Yeah.
Down to 84. Now, don't look at the dollar yen. That's the dollar's value in yen. It's going up. I get clients who tell me, Jim, you got it backwards. I said, no, you got it backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
You're looking at the dollar. It's called dollar yen because it's dollar in yen. Wake up. It's called euro dollar because it's a euro in dollar terms. Wake up. So the yen went down 1% on a single day last
week. Yep, just last week. Yes.
Right. So, all right, here's where it gets weird and ugly. The Japanese banks, I'm hearing now, they're giant. They're at risk. And I couldn't lay out for you exactly how they're at risk, but you cannot monkey around with your currency and have it do a dive bomb. Remember post Fukushima, I had a forecast that all the money coming back home for the reconstruction and repair for the nation. Lots and lots of damage, the tsunami and all kinds of damage. Well, I had a forecast that they were going to go from 110, 108 on the yen, not dollar yen, the yen in terms of dollar, it would go up to about 120, 125, and it did. It did in 2 months. It was another correct forecast. It's gone all the way down from 120 range 2 years ago to 85, 84 now, and it's probably going to go below 80. You cannot do that. You cannot do that. What it's going to do is going to raise all their costs that are imported. So they import 99 or 98% of all their oil.
Right, right.
They're trying to make a transfer over to LNG as quickly as possible. All that's going to go up in cost. So when the U.S. promises them the cheaper yen will actually help your export industry, did they overlook the cost factor?
Well, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a standard Keynesian central planner logic.
Well, you know, it's the same thing that gets overlooked with QE in the United States. The cost structure goes up because all the formal hedging goes against the paper debauchery and what do you call it, undermining the dollar, undermining the paper currency system with printing. So crude oil went up. All the material prices went up. And now we're seeing the opposite. You know, QE is, we're told, is coming to an end. And crude oil went down, gold went down. All the things that are paper leveraged versus the dollar are going down. And, you know, everybody's happy, but this is how the system breaks. My forecast, a weird forecast I made 2 or 3 years ago is, well, you're going to have a really good signal, plain as day, on all the marquee billboards for when we're in the end game. The dollar will rise, then it will rise some more, and when it continues rising, it'll do so right before it dies. And now we're seeing that. It's very hard for people, like clients, to say, yeah, I can see that's a correct forecast, because they don't see that it's dying. They just see that it's going up, and, you know, gasoline has maybe stopped going up in cost. But here's some of the fallout. This is going to get very, very dangerous and weird and ugly and combative. If the Japanese suddenly get a currency advantage with the cheaper yen, what happens to Chinese export trade? What happens to Korean export trade? What happens to Hong Kong export trade? What happens to Singapore and Taiwan export trade?
Yep.
Okay. Singapore and Taiwan each have a currency called the dollar, which means that they're very much tied in on the financial strings. Hong Kong has a dollar. So Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, dollar. China's not going to sit back and say, okay, well, you know, with your big motorcycle industry, we're going to just give that up because China has a nascent, very successful motorcycle industry. I see Chinese names on motorcycles almost every single day in Costa Rica. They're very big in export. So we're going to get a currency war in Asia. That's the consequence of the United States doing this grab, seizure, confiscation. I prefer the word commandeer. Commandeer has military implications. All right, they're still under our thumb. So we're going to get a currency war. You know, Samsung, look at the Korean big names. Samsung, LG, Hyundai.
Yeah.
They're not going to sit back. They're not going to sit back and let Sony in Japan take over. Let Toyota in Japan take over. What's the other one? Well, okay, I got most of them. You get the idea.
Yeah.
These countries are not going to sit back. So we're going to see a lot of damage, and we're going to see what I believe is going to be the importers suddenly stopping. They're going to say, well, this is very uncertain now in Asia. We got these big orders with Korea. We don't know what's going on. We're hearing that the Koreans are going to try to reduce their currency. So we're going to delay these orders. And then there's going to be a reverse psychology going on. They're going to delay Japanese orders because they're going to suspect a rebound in the yen. So the whole export trade with Asia is going to get messed up.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Fed. Yep. The U.S. Fed, thank you. This is how the dollar is killing the entire world economy and financial structure.
Well, and in that big picture, Jim, I mean, it's just another step toward the de-dollarization. You've spoken eloquently for years about the death of the petrodollar and how Saudi Arabia, you know, is destined to move away from a partnership with the U.S. and move more toward Russia and China. I mean, I'm sure you probably still see this as just a step in that direction as well, right?
It is, and I'd like to take this opportunity. I had an interview a couple of days ago with Paul Sandu, and I got something wrong, and I like to admit my errors because I do make them. I do make them, and I'm an honest Joe. I got a lot of compliments in my 23 years of working as a statistical analyst in quality control and then marketing research and then sales forecasting analysis. When I make an error, I admit it, and it's how you retain any integrity that you might have. I said that the falling yen would undercut the Japanese yen carry trade when it's the opposite.
Sure.
If Americans and Europeans and Londoners borrow Japanese yen in order to invest in U.S. stocks or higher-yielding U.K. gilts or whatever, well, if the yen goes down, then it actually adds to their profit. So I got that backwards. But there is something that might have happened with the Japanese on a carry trade, but not the yen carry trade. The Japanese might have overdone their borrowing, the 0% money in Japan, from 1992 and for the next 10 or 15 years, they might have overdone it. That was the official yen carry trade that New York and Wall Street and London both participated in. Borrow the 0% Japanese money and invest in U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, British bonds, and British debt.
Mm-hmm.
British bonds and British stocks. Okay, so that was the yen carry trade. But now they might have overdone it. And they might have had orders from the big financial institutions in Japan close out the yen carry trade, but there might have been a reverse carry trade. The Japanese might have borrowed the 0% money in the United States for the last 3 years.
Well, yeah.
And invested in Japanese stocks. So their imported carry trade, the dollar carry trade for them, that is at risk of being blown up. So the point is the same. The Japanese are engaged in carry trades, and their banks might blow up from the damage to those carry trades, but I got the point wrong, and I like to make that.
No, all that's right. Certainly fine. No, we all in these interviews, you know, those things happen. So thanks for clearing that up.
Well, they get complicated, Craig. This is sure. Extremely messy stuff.
Right.
I mean, try to explain someone like Staples in Los Angeles importing Japanese and Thailand and Taiwan products and Hong Kong product, explain to them the hedging process using the Japanese yen. I mean, it's very difficult to explain to the novice, and I'm not new to this, and I was embarrassed early morning yesterday. Oh, my gosh, I got that backwards. Then I got an email from a client. I wrote him back and said, nice call. You got it, too. This morning I realized the error. But the point is that the Japanese banks are involved in carry trades. It's part of their nature since 1990. And I think they've been borrowing a lot of free U.S. money. And they've been investing it where they know best, Chinese industries, yep. Chinese stocks, Asian industries, Japanese stock. There are a lot of Asian industries on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So we're going to get a trade war on the currency side in Asia. And what's the fallout going to be? All of Asia will be united against the dollar.
Yes.
That's going to be the outcome eventually. It's not going to happen in a month. We're going to get the currency war coming, and in a couple months, I think the Chinese, Taiwanese, Koreans, and Hong Kong all get together and say, we're not going to tolerate this crap. Hong Kong, by the way, they're pegged to the dollar, so they're not going to see much currency move at all. But the rest will, and it's really the whole Pacific Rim. You got Singapore, you got Indonesia, you got a lot of plants there that are making products for Western markets. I think we're going to see the Japanese, after they have this snap vote and dismiss the faction coalition for Abe, I think Abe is going to be tossed to the curb. And boy, wouldn't it be nice if the U.S. could do the same and toss out the Kenyan? We don't operate that way. We have these political parties that are both controlled by Langley. I mean, I call them the red-coated narcos and the blue-coated narcos. They're both narcos, and anyone who doesn't understand the narcos in U.S. politics, you are somewhere between an ignoramus and brain dead. Now, you mentioned the Saudis. Should we get to that, Craig?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, you've got that, let's call it Eastern Alliance, that is moving westward, eventually into the, you know, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, if you will. You know, eventually we'll bring in India and Pakistan and Iran and all the way over perhaps to Saudi Arabia and up to Russia. Well, Russia's already in it. I take that back.
Yeah, well, I look much more closely at the G20. I'm sorry, the BRICS.
Right.
The BRICS are now talking openly. And we got a new acronym. Now, BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Well, what's MINT? What's MINT? The BRICS are talking about joining with the MINT countries and inviting them into maybe, I don't think full-fledged membership, but strong voting membership, a good vote share. MINT is Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Turkey. Those are good-sized second-tier countries.
Mm-hmm.
Look at what's happening in Turkey. Just this week, Biden had to leave a public a public speaking appearance, should I call it, because he feared for his life with an angry mob who were saying, get out.
I didn't know that.
So Biden is not welcome in Turkey, in Ankara. And for those who don't know it, ISIS is operated, funded, and created by Langley, the U.S. government security agencies, and they operate their field offices out of the U.S. embassy in Turkey. And Turkey doesn't like it. They don't like it.
Well, I would imagine. I mean, they're right on their border, and Turkey's reluctant to get involved in the fight. Is that why?
Well, they see ISIS as not exactly being pro-Turkey.
Right.
Because ISIS wants to integrate, say, Kurdistan, the Iraqi territory that's loaded with oil. So there's a lot of cross currents going on here. Anyway, my point is that Turkey, which is making enormous, very large scale energy deals with Russia, not to so much, you know, bring in the pipeline. It's different with Turkey and Russia. Russia is building them gigantic natural gas storage facilities. Russia is building them nuclear electricity plants. Russia is doing a lot of different things with Turkey. And Turkey is pretty much at the point of getting out of the EU right now.
Right.
And once they do that, they're going to be having second thoughts about remaining in NATO.
Sure. Yeah.
And that will bring in huge questions on the narcotics that the U.S. grows in Afghanistan, controls 90% of the global production for heroin. The U.S. controls 90% of the global production of heroin in Afghanistan, ships it through Kosovo, and then in Sirlik Air Force Base, NATO base in Turkey. The Turks are going to have some very serious deliberations on remaining in NATO, and on the table will be heroin.
Excuse me.
On the table will be heroin. All right, so what does Nigeria offer? A lot of crude oil. What does Indonesia offer? A lot of crude oil.
Yeah.
What does Mexico offer? Very interesting mix of crude oil,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, way down for Pemex. Their output is way down. But what has Pemex done in just the last year to ramp up? They got rid of their law that forbade, I hate that word, that prohibited foreign companies from being involved in exploration in Mexico. So guess who's right there? Russia. Russia's right there. And China controls all the Mexican ports. Isn't it interesting that China also controls the Los Angeles port and the Vancouver port and the Port Richey port north of Vancouver in Canada? they control the ports. So they also control the Australian ports. These guys are not stupid. So Mexico offers a different mix. Now, there was a railway deal, high-speed railway deal, that the U.S., I'm sure, just made a phone call to Mexico City and said, you know, get rid of that deal, would you please? We'll ship you some more rifles on the Fast and Furious gun running.
Well, but I don't want to go back to this kind of de-dollarization idea and how this seems to be accelerating. Yeah, and two points that loosely or maybe not so loosely tie together is this: because of the U.S.-sponsored events in Ukraine and this attempt to turn all of Europe against Russia, the U.S. has put all these overt, kind of silly sanctions to some extent on Russia. And I've contended since the oil price began to crash in June and July, that was a covert sanction to manipulate the paper crude oil market to really hit Russia in its natural resources belly, if you will. And so crude oil has been going down, and then there's this kind of connection that gets mentioned that maybe Saudi Arabia is complicit in that in return for U.S. help, you know, and other, or the U.S. will help them out if Saudi Arabia promotes a lower oil price and all this kind of stuff. And so that obviously is impacting OPEC, which meets later this week. I mean, and it sure seems like all these things are aligning to accelerate this kind of de-dollarization end of the petrodollar. Is that how it seems to you as well, Jim?
No, it does not.
Okay.
In fact, I think the U.S. focus has been to reduce and bring down the ruble, so much to bring down the oil price, bring down the ruble and force all the imports into Russia to be more expensive and give them an inflation whack from their currency.
All right, that's interesting.
And on the oil side, what country is most sensitive to the oil price as far as a lot of its new marginal production of oil in the last couple of years? It's the United States.
The U.S., yeah.
So what we've done is we've reduced the ruble, and we've watched as the dollar's gone up. I think the crude oil price has gone down mainly because the dollar has gone up from the global economy getting screwed to the pooch.
Sure.
So you've got, just take example, there's a French business, and they say, oh gosh, everything's going to hell here, the euro's going down, let's put our money in treasuries, in the dollar. Okay, then you got a company in Pakistan, they're seeing all kinds of problems, let's put our spare money in the dollar. You got a company in not Buenos Aires, because they got a ban, but let's say Ecuador, let's put money in the dollar. All these countries are putting money in the dollar as a refuge. And as a result, based on the mechanisms that are already in place with London and New York, the crude oil price goes down. I believe China convinced the Saudis to push down the oil price. And believe it, because ever since March, there's been a monthly love fest, a big conference summit, high-level meetings with ministers level in Beijing, and the Saudis are there. So you think they're going to do something that the Saudis don't want?
Right.
No.
Right.
No. You had John Kerry appearing in a photo op with King Abdullah just a couple months ago, and a lot of speculation. Looks like the U.S. is getting Saudi to push down the oil price. No, the Chinese are, in my opinion, because what are the Chinese advantages to a lower oil price? Well, first of all, the sanctions with Ukraine against Russia softened the Russians into coming to the table to make the Holy Grail meeting and deal. So without the Russian sanctions, the Russians might not have offered a better price for gas to the Chinese for the 30-year contract. Okay, so it looks like the Russian sanctions and the lower energy prices benefited China. How else did it benefit China? what country actually has economic growth in this world? China.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're getting a benefit with lower oil price, lower energy price, lower gas prices, and all this infrastructure investment. When you have infrastructure investment, what it means is a lot of people get employed. In the United States, we have no effing idea what capitalism is or capital formation. We want to get the economy going. Our knucklehead Kenyan president and his predecessor, the 80 IQ Bush, said, let's get more money, let's put more money in consumers' pockets.
Right.
Why don't we try to build businesses?
Right, right.
Why don't we try to hire people by reducing federal taxes, reducing onerous federal bureaucratic red tape nonsense, and encourage the formation of businesses and get Wall Street banks to actually lend money to businesses instead of just running their carry trades and derivative shops. They're running a gigantic carry trade, borrow 0% treasury bill rate money and, you know, short that and invest in the long bond. You got a 2%, 3% spread there. Put on your 30-fold leverage with futures. Poof. You got 60 to 90% per year on your bet.
And you can,
with a wink, wink from Bernanke now yelling, don't worry, we'll never raise the interest rate because we don't want to blow up Wall Street in their carry trade. These
right.
carry trades are extremely important.
Right.
No, but I think China is a beneficiary of this, laughing all the way, because the victim here of lower oil prices is the U.S. shale industry, and worse. Big oil has a lot of junk bonds that are based on the shale industry with covenants that are failing right now. So do you really think the lower oil price is great for America?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. It certainly makes sense, Jim, the way you've laid it out, and I hadn't thought of it all that way. I mean, it does make me think then, if that's correct, then this idea that the Saudis are have already moved away from relying on the U.S. as their closest partner. I mean, they're the ones that have been the pivotal partner in the whole petrodollar scheme now for over 40 years. It sounds like they've already turned to China as their closer ally.
Well, we talked about this even, I would say, in a couple of different interviews in the last year.
Yeah.
I regarded in mid-2013 the petrodollar as it's being shown the door. And we were talking about, you know, the upcoming demise of the petrodollar. We're seeing hints of it. Why are the Chinese so interested in Saudi Arabia? Why are they having these monthly summit meetings?
Yeah.
I don't care that Kerry went to visit Abdullah. Obama went to visit Abdullah in March. I think it was April. President Obama, our Kenyan president.
Yes.
He went to visit Abdullah, and the meeting was abruptly ended.
Yeah.
In 15 minutes.
Called
not
off,
only
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Not only that, but the Department of Treasury had lots of pamphlets that they handed out, and they asked for them back. They also had website promotions of the summit meeting, and they got rid of the entire web pages, and the speculation was ripe. What happened with Obama and Abdullah? I'll tell you what happened. Abdullah told him, we don't like your ISIS tool. It's threatening Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like your covert organization called ISIS that's beheading people with false videos. You know, take a look at these videos. There's no blood squirting out of the heads, the necks. There's no blood squirting out of the necks.
I haven't seen one. It's not something that I've been, you know, I look for, but I'll have to check that out.
I've only seen one. I've got numerous clients who say, yeah, how about that? When you cut off a head, blood squirts like a garden hose.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, Saudis probably told Obama, we don't like your ISIS. We understand your motive for it because you couldn't control the Iraqi government that you helped form with your nation building. It turned out to be a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. So now you're going to pull out your ace card called ISIS and take over the government, take over the oil fields, steal central bank gold like in Mosul, where they captured $400 million in cash. And they probably, Obama was probably told, we don't like what you're doing in the Middle East with this next phase. And Obama probably told him, you don't like it? You know, in your ear with a can of beer. We got a moron puppet for a president.
Right. Well,
we've got all these assets. And I'd like to point out with you, Craig, what Saudi Arabia is going to be doing with gold.
Well, that's actually what I was just going to ask you, because you've got excellent contacts throughout Europe and in that region. You know, two of the things that I know you've been discussing with some of your subscribers is this idea that there are some sovereign wealth funds that are being built over there for maybe the disposal of treasuries. But then additionally, how much Saudi gold has been pillaged and resold and released and rehypothecated and sold out from under them, and that might ultimately lead some to the end of the dollar relationship too.
I have been studying since 2007 the Saudi reserve capacity. What is the size of their oil reserves?
Right.
I mean, the whole concept put out by what was his name? The guy who was murdered, the oil expert. I can't think of his name, sadly. Bill something. Anyway. The Oil Drum is a website that gives tremendous information about the engineering and, you know, the water cut, which is the percentage of the produced oil that's actually water. The water cut, as the water cut goes up for Saudi oil production in, say, Ghawar is their gigantic 40-year, 50-year oil field. Well, to maintain pressure down there in order to pump up the remaining oil, they put in water.
Sure.
And they also put in methane because, you know, you can pressurize the methane. You can't pressurize the water. You can a little bit. It just doesn't work like pressurizing gas.
Sure.
So up comes the oil, but it's 95% water in Saudi Arabia in the biggest, oldest oil fields like Ghawar. They got about three really old oil fields. Some of them are names that don't roll off your tongue. Have a lot of weird letters in there. All right, so I've been convinced ever since 2007 that the Saudis are indeed in a rapid depletion. And when I heard a couple of years ago their water cut, which was 70% back in 2007 when I was starting to look at this, 75%, it's now 95%. So the Saudis talk about having spare capacity. I don't think they have much. And they didn't have to do a lot to bring down the oil price because the global demand due to global recession is way down. All right, so enough of all that. I think a year ago that the U.S. threw the Saudis under the bus. They concluded, we can afford to lose the Saudis as allies. And here's where the Reich arrogance, the Nazi arrogance enters the formula. Because we believe the whole world is deeply committed to the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily need the Saudis, because we got other Arabs. And maybe the other Arabs will go slowly, but we can pitch the Saudis under the bus. They're not about to dump their treasury bonds, because it would kill their country. It would kill their royal bank accounts. And here's the wild card. Let's start stealing. This is 3-4 years ago. Let's start stealing the Saudi gold because they won't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where UBS came in. Now, you may have heard the story starting in 2011. UBS and all of its foreign bank accounts and illegal hidden accounts with American clients and all the tax evasion with the American clients. And UBS finally gave up in about 2012, late in the year, and handed over their full client list. And okay, UBS is now pretty much run by Washington, D.C. what were they after? Do you really think they wanted to stop tax evasion by Joe Schmo, U.S. citizen? Or did they want to steal a couple hundred or maybe 1,000 tons of gold? All right, gets better. Early this year, Credit Suisse was attacked by the U.S. government.
Yep.
You know, big fines,
yep,
whatever. And the prevailing story was that Credit Suisse was involved with a lot of tax evasion accounts for American clients. We want to stop this. We want to bring in all this tax revenue. What, they want to bring in an extra $40 million in tax revenue? Huh?
Yeah.
No, no. How about the Credit Suisse gold accounts for the Saudis? All those several hundred tons.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did the story get told? They give you the pieces. You just have to put them together.
Yeah.
They said that we wanted to have Credit Suisse reorganized and folded under UBS control to reduce administrative costs.
Right.
Can you say to steal the rest of the Saudi gold?
Yeah.
Now, it's not just Saudi gold. The UAE has a lot of gold, and I don't know what percentage is stored in Dubai and what percentage is stored in Switzerland. Now, here's an argument for you. If you're doing as Dubai does, a lot of oil trade with Europe, you know, shipping it through the Suez Canal for European clients, the Europeans pay for it. They pay for it in treasury bonds sitting in their banking system. Well, if they just move the treasury bonds from France, Italy, Spain, Greece, Germany, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and just move it over to Switzerland, they can buy gold with it. Mm-hmm. That's what maybe they did 15, 20 years ago. We don't have to move all this money. We don't have to ship the gold to Dubai. We could just store it in the highly reliable, prestigious Swiss banks where it was stolen. Okay, so UAE might have, Kuwait might have, Oman might have, Bahrain might have, a lot of gold sitting in Swiss banks that was stolen. Now, can you say motive to dump the dollar in the treasury bonds?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the Persian Gulf, they really like the name the Gulf region now instead of Persian Gulf. The Gulf region, I added it up when the Saudis did something that I'll get to in a minute. I added it up. Added up all the different sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf nations. And they're really quite considerable. The UAE is the biggest. They've got two of them. Each of two is over $500 billion. UAE does not have a big population like Saudi does. UAE does not have a big deficit like Saudi does. UAE just drills the oil, ships it, sells it, and puts it in their bank accounts. UAE is unique in the Persian Gulf. I'm sorry, the Gulf region. All right, I added it all up. $2.2 trillion worth of sovereign wealth funds among all the Gulf Emirates. And the Saudis are not a real big player in that. They got something like $270 billion. I mean, that's sizable, but it's only, you know, 15% of all the Gulf Emirates sovereign wealth funds. Over half of it is just UAE. All right, so if you're looking at the $2.2 trillion, the next big question is how much of that is in dollar-denominated assets like treasury bonds? Because zero are in mortgage bonds.
Yeah.
Islamic rules and regulations, they actually have laws. You don't have anything invested in Western mortgage bonds. They don't do that. They don't have mortgages. They buy with cash or they don't buy at all.
Usury
law. So I'm guessing, based on some input I got from my crack team of colleagues, we've got about 10 of us. We call ourselves a brain trust, and you know, our colleagues or the gang. Or let me ask the rest of the gang what they have to say about this. We're guessing at about two-thirds of it might be in U.S. denominated things like treasury bonds and big New York stocks. You know, Prince Wallaweed,
right?
Which I like to call him Prince Dickweed. Prince Dickweed has a huge investment in Citibank.
Right, still does, doesn't he?
What is it? Is it, you know, $30 billion? I don't know. It might be. I don't. Is it $100 billion? I don't think so. All right, so bank stocks don't add up when you're comparing to treasury bonds. They don't compare well. So I'm thinking that the Gulf region sovereign wealth funds might have something on the order of $1.3 trillion, $1.5 trillion. And the Saudis have asked the Americans, don't publish our numbers properly. So the tick reports, I think, are full of crap. Mm,
could be, yeah.
I don't think China owns more treasury bonds than the Gulf Emirates. So that's a lot of treasury bonds and New York Wall Street, you know, stocks and Wall Street bonds. You got to count them too because they're significant. That's part of the capitalization of these big wrecked insolvent banks.
Right.
All right. So the Saudis are – it's more the UAE. I actually got some input. I've got a client who's in UAE, and he said, Jim, you mentioned UAE once in a while, but you need to understand something. UAE is now desperate to diversify out of the dollar because they see the end of the petrodollar coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, all right, I understand they've got this $700 billion sovereign wealth fund and a $500 billion wealth fund. That's $1.2 trillion. What percentage of that is in treasury bonds? And he said, I would be shocked if it's less than two-thirds. So they've got this huge exposure of something like $800 billion, just UAE.
Wow.
And they want to get out of the treasury bonds because they see what's going on with QE. They see that the support for its value is the printing press and QE bond monetization. And they see the end of the petrodollar, and they see the Saudis marching over to Beijing once a month. So they see the end of the petrodollar, and, you know, then a big event happened, which really triggered my investigation of how much the Gulf Emirate sovereign wealth funds are worth. I got news that the Riyadh Central Bank announced a bilateral office. They're going to call it a sovereign wealth fund in Riyadh, independent of their central bank.
Hmm.
And it was going to be used for asset purchases. Well, what they should have said was for diversification out of U.S. Treasury
for
other non-dollar assets.
Right, right.
Because they're overloaded with Treasury bonds, and any asset purchases are bloody well not going to be in the dollar. So I put a question out to The Voice, who mentioned this story.
Yeah.
And he said, wink, wink, who do you think was their advisor?
And what do you think they might diversify into? It sounds like that might be their way, just like the lineup now, everybody trying to jump the queue to repatriate their gold in Europe. Perhaps that will only exacerbate the physical gold demand by the Saudi and other sovereign wealth funds wanting to get some of their gold back while they can.
That's exactly what I think is going to happen. We're seeing momentum grow every month, and factors behind it push like crowbars or like a big sharp needle stuck in their ass.
Yeah, yeah.
The UAE right now, the Emirates, the Emir and his princes, I'm told they're pissing in their pants. That's what I'm hearing. They cannot move into gold fast enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So my question to The Voice, I said, all right, so you're advising the Saudis to create this sovereign wealth fund independent of the Riyadh Central Bank. And he said, yes, they will probably see company. And I said, oh, you mean like Kuwait, UAE,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oman will all work through the Riyadh Sovereign Wealth Fund and use that office and that window to purchase gold, perhaps through Dubai? And he wrote back and said something like, I think you see the point.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's right. Not at liberty to say yes, and let me explain how and why.
Right, exactly.
He just says you read that correctly or you're on the right track or You understand the picture. He's got his way of replying to me that is not explicit, because I think he's under contract where he really can't speak freely.
Right.
But I'd like to mention something else. You know, I cited the UBS case in 2011. I cited the Credit Suisse case for the other. There are only two giant big banks in Switzerland, and the U.S. is all over both of them because that's how they steal the Saudi gold. There's another case that the U.S. was all over, and that was BNP Paribas.
Right.
The French bank.
Did that first, didn't it?
That was first, yes. And I investigated. I think we covered this in past discussions. But just quickly, that's how the U.S. blocked the BRICS nations of using the big French bank to dump their treasury bonds and source gold.
How about that? Which is kind of similar to what you just described. These Middle Eastern nations are doing.
Right. So you've got on one side blocking the purchase of gold, and the other side blocking the conversion of treasury bonds toward gold. So, you know, it's getting very gnarly.
Yes. And I think, Jim, we're about, everybody listening, we're more than 50 minutes into this. And you know, there is another three-day holiday coming up in about 4 weeks. So what I'd like to do is maybe pick this up, continue this discussion there, if that's okay with you. I mean, would you be able to come back in December?
When have I ever turned you down?
Good point. Thank you. And you're very generous with your time. But there is...
Let me add something about Ukraine.
Okay. Well, okay, sure.
We didn't get to that fully. We talked about Russian sanctions. But, you know, I don't want to go on and on, you know, at length regarding Ukraine. But the U.S. and the EU commissioners, which are basically pedophile tools of Washington. I don't use that word loosely. British political leaders and EU commissioners are some of the most sordid people ever walked this planet.
Those details are coming out daily, it seems.
They're coming out all the time, including Buckingham Palace.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the U.S. and EU fascists are pretty much giving Europe a choice. Stick with us, hold firm with the Russian sanctions, even if it destroys your economy. Do the right thing. And the EU countries, one after the other, are going to get tremendous pressure from two sectors in their economy, not the bankers. The two sectors are going to be the industrial corporations.
Yeah.
And it's already happening. Siemens just announced something like a 20% profit decline and a 50% order decline from their Russian subsidiary. You got 3,000 to 5,000 German companies operating in Russia. They're all at risk. You got energy companies that are wondering, what are we going to do? We got Russian sanctions. You got Exxon even involved, British Petroleum involved, Dutch Shell involved. So the two sectors are going to give a lot of heat to their internal governments to break out of the EU. I don't mean that loosely. I mean get out of the European Union. It's the industrial sector and the farm sector.
Yeah.
Just this past week, tons of French farmer manure, I'm talking cow shit.
Yeah.
Was dumped on French government offices' doorways.
I know they love to do that. I didn't know they were doing that just this past week again.
Yeah, well, they typically in the past have dumped tons of potatoes on the highways and the big boulevards in Paris. Now they're dumping trucks of farm manure on bureaucrats' offices to voice their displeasure. Here's where the breakpoint's going to come. Shareholders are going to say to the industrial, you know, the executives,
mm-hmm.
We don't like these sanctions. We're going to get rid of you, you know, Helmut.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get rid of you in Germany. We're going to get rid of you, Hans. We're going to get rid of you, Pierre, in France.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get rid of you as executives from a shareholder revolt unless you put pressure on the government to stop these sanctions. That's one side. Here's the other, and this is going to be a beauty. It's coming. the agricultural firms in Spain and Italy, you got to be aware, but there are 14,000 Italian companies operating farms. They're all hurting. Greek farms, Spain, Italy, Portugal, France, all these farms are going to experience an episode where they're threatened with bankruptcy. Watch the Chinese come in to buy them up. And then comes political pressure. Stop the carpetbagging encroachment of our native agricultural farm businesses by the Chinese, because what they're going to do after they buy the Spanish farm is to divert half the output to China.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get corporate sector and farm pressure, farm sector pressure against these sanctions. And one by one, these nations are going to say, F you to Washington, F you to Brussels. We don't want to be in your union anymore. If you bring your European commissioners to our country anymore, we're going to have them arrested.
And we're going to dump cow poop on them.
Yeah, and here's where a nice, funny little a wing-ding side window is going to happen. I've had this as a forecast for the last couple months. Ever since the Russian counter-sanctions came in, I said, Turkey is going to import European food. And we're not just talking about, you know, fruits and vegetables. It includes meats, pork, beef, chicken, all kinds of beef, all kinds of meat. I believe the Turks are going to import farm products from Southern Europe and move it on to Russia.
And then go ahead and go around the sanctions.
Right. Turkey does this for oil. They did it. Remember that
right.
was the prototype for oil with Iran.
Right.
And all you need to do is to see the Greek border open up with Turkey and start shipping. Because then you're going to start to see Italy move their products into Greece. It's just a hop, skip, and jump.
Yeah.
So this is coming. The Ukraine sanctions are going to force the Europeans not just to move closer toward non-dollar trade, because the Russians have already told them, you want to buy our oil and gas? You pay in rubles, you pay in yuan, RMB. Wow, that's big. That's very big.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to see pressure for them to break out of the European Union. And you're starting to see it already. There was a law just passed in the Hungarian parliament. Now, bear in mind that they're not a real solid citizen member of the EU, but they're closely aligned and enjoy some NATO benefits. But Orban, he's a really good-looking guy. Hungarian language is pretty nice sounding. I watched a clip of Orban giving a speech where he basically said, we're going to continue with the South Stream pipeline for Gazprom. We don't care about your EU laws. So they had a parliamentary meeting, and they passed a law that said, we don't care about your EU laws about, you know, 50-50 ownership, and the transit company must be independent and local, and all kinds of EU obstacles for Gazprom. Hungary said, F you. And I listened to this clip, and Orban is a real defiant guy. Let's see if there's an attempt on Orban's life, the Prime Minister of Hungary. I've got a client from Hungary who keeps me informed about what's going on in Hungary. So it's very – I tell you, that my inbox is nice. And when I mention here in closing the Golden Jackass website and the Hat Trick Letter newsletter, the Golden Jack website has lots of public articles, and it features – radio interview links.
Right.
Far fewer public articles than years ago. I used to write one, honestly, Craig, I used to write one at least 40, 45 a year. I mean, they were almost one a week. Oh, it's Wednesday, got to write a public article. And it was promotional, but now I really enjoy the interviews, and I'm getting more invitations because of a string of correct forecasts. But anyway, there's people can go to the website, and there are two monthly reports. One's called the Money War Report.
Yep.
High level. And the other one's called the Golden Currency Report. That's ground level. I used to call it low level, but now I call it ground level because it's not low.
That sounds good, yeah.
No, mint coin demand.
And that's all part of the Hat Trick letter, right? Your subscription service.
But I'd like to give a lot of thanks. I'm going to start doing this more because I realize my colleagues are very valuable. They provide information. They provide analysis. It's not just an article that Craig or Nosh or Greg or Kevin or Eric send. It's not just an article. It's well, here's what it means.
Right.
Oh, man, I tell you, it's a big advantage. It makes me almost as smart as they are. My colleagues are very smart. And Paul. Paul's a new entry.
And you subscribe to the Hat Trick letter at, is it thegoldenjackass.com or goldenjackass.com?
www.goldenjackass.com.
Okay. Make sure everybody knows that. And there's a link here on this podcast page.
And I'd also like to thank the dozens of clients. I've got quite a few who send me stuff and say, hey, you might have seen this already. But I actually tell them, don't preface that I might have seen it already. I usually get 2, 3, or 4 of the every same big story from different clients and my colleagues. And that's okay. If I've already seen it, then fine. But maybe half the stuff they send me I haven't seen. So don't apologize for the half that I don't see. So I thank them because my inbox is rich.
Sure. I feel the same way.
But they need to be careful, though, because if they insult my integrity as clients, I will boot them. I will boot them, and I've booted 2 in the last several months. I've just kicked them out, an insult. Jim, you got everything wrong on the gold market, everything wrong. And I say, well, are you aware that the gold price paper side is now diverging from the physical side? The voice told me that there's a minimum of 30 to 35% price premium paid on large gold purchases, like in the neighborhood of $50 million. That's a $300 to $400 premium by Asian buyers on large gold purchases. So I told this clown client, well, if that's the case, you've got a $400 or $500 difference between the physical gold price and the paper gold price, which is a correct forecast of mine of a divergence between paper and physical gold. And he said, yeah, you just can't admit it. You got everything wrong. He's gone. Well, I don't tolerate insults like that. And another guy insulted me this past week. He better watch himself. I'm about ready to boot him. He called me basically a plagiarizer for taking his image of a whirling dervish that I used as an image to describe the credit derivatives. A whirling dervish providing a false basis with imaginary mass.
Right.
And he said, Jim, why don't you give credit where it's due? You stole an image of mine. No, I didn't. I've used whirling dervish many times in the past. My dad used it all the time to describe a certain ride in an amusement park. So I never read his email because he sends me 4 or 5 a day. And, 2 or 3 of them are chatty. I don't read them all. If you get chatty with me as a client, I'm not going to read them all.
Jim, I hear you.
Yeah. Well, we both take a lot of crap.
Yes.
From occasional clients. But I will say this. Under 2% of my inbox from clients is insulting and borderline abusive. Under 2, probably closer to 1%. I used to get a lot of hate mail in 05 and 04. That was before I had the string of correct forecasts.
Jim, it comes with the territory, my friend. But I do want to pick this up next month, so let's stop here. But you've laid out a number of issues that are going to accelerate. I mean, clearly the U.S. is backing every corner of the world into a corner, whether it's the BRICS, the Middle East, the EU, the Russians. And everything's going to accelerate in 2015. So I think it's going to be timely for us to get together again in about 4 weeks and kind of pick up this conversation there. But you've been extraordinarily generous with your time. And I know everyone's really enjoyed listening to you. And I want everybody to go to goldenjackass.com and check out, buy yourself a Christmas present. Get yourself a subscription to the Hat Trick Letter. And then you don't have to wait for our occasional discussions to hear directly from you. Jim,
I'd like to close with one little comment. It's exactly what you were just saying. We stole the gold in Libya. We stole all the gold in Tunisia. We stole the Saudi gold. We're stealing the Syria gold. We stole the Ukraine gold.
Yep.
That's what these wars are all about. Now we're about to steal the pension funds of Japan. So my line is, the U.S. is running out of nations to plunder its wealth. And now we've turned to our allies.
They're not going to be allies very long. It's going to be 2015 is going to be some kind of year. And I look forward to visiting with you again soon. Jim, thank you so much for your time. And we'll do this again in a few weeks, God willing.
And unless you send me abusive email.
That's right, unless I do that. Happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
And all right,
we'll visit again soon.
All right, bye. Thanks.